Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bradfield, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
May I be seated, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're back from a brief recess. This is our third of four oral arguments for this morning. This is case number A19-0482, John Edward Warrington versus Karen Lee Warrington. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and counsel for respondent, 15 minutes as well. And counsel for appellant, 5 minutes after for rebuttal, if you so choose to use that. When you approach the podium, you can adjust it up and down. There's a button right underneath in the middle. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Matthew Gilbert representing appellant Karen Warrington. The parties appeared for trial in February of 2017. There's a two-day trial. Following trial in April of 2017, appellant became aware that respondent had obtained a promotion. And as a part of his promotion, respondent had represented numerous times that his increase in income was nominal. Based upon that representation, the district court denied appellant's request to reopen the record.
And what was the increase?
The increase went from about $340,000 per year to approximately $500,000 per year. So it was a very significant 40% increase in income.
And you're talking base salary. Is that, are you talking that separate from the overtime?
There is no overtime. So it's just his income. And there is a finding regarding this. And respondent is a pilot. And under the FAA, they can only fly so many hours out of the year.
77 hours a month.
I believe it's 1,000 hours a year.
But anything over that is overtime, though, isn't it?
Well, that they cannot actually fly that amount of time over that amount. And even under the statute, there's a finding in the district court's most recent order, which basically says that it was not overtime income. And under statute, in order for anything to be overtime, you need to work over 40 hours per week, which has never happened. Along with that, so following the bear with me a moment here.
So the 40% increase was in net or gross?
Gross. Okay. Gross income. Following that in 2018, so the very next year, appellant filed a motion to modify spousal maintenance and child support. And in doing so, she identified that respondent's income had increased 40% from $344,000 to $482,000. At the same time, appellant's income had plummeted from $167,000 to $89,000, and that's a 46.5% decrease in income. Respondent had also moved to Memphis, Tennessee during this time period, and he no longer was required to pay state income tax as a part of this, and he had a much more affordable cost of living, because he now lived in Tennessee, which was a lot different than Edina, Minnesota, where he had lived before.
Is there anything in the record indicating what effect, if any, the lack of state income tax would have on his income?
Again, there's no state income tax, so in the record, it doesn't specifically describe what that amount would come to. I do apologize. There's cash flow analysis that was prepared of both parties' respective incomes. And in that analysis, it does take into consideration both parties' net after-tax income, including Mr. Warrington no longer having to pay state income tax. Additionally,
So what would be the difference then between his net income?
The net amount be?
Correct.
I don't have those exact figures before me, but again, the gross number was a 40% increase as far as his income. Go ahead.
In terms of the process for district courts when they're presented with a motion to modify maintenance or support, there are statutory presumptions that apply, and in order to determine whether the presumption is in favor or against, I guess you would think of it, and the reasonability of the current order, the court would have to do a little math. And it's not just looking at respondents' income, but also appellants. So what number should the court have used in trying to determine whether or not there had been a sufficient change in her income in order to trigger the statutory presumption? Because the decree obviously has kind of a moving target for purposes of her income. It sets out what it thinks the current is, but then expects it to drop and then come back up to an expectation of $200,000 by 3 years, which would be this summer, 2020. June of 2020 or July of 2020 would be 3 years from that would match that decree. So what is the starting point that the court should have used to make that comparison? You'd made the comparison. You picked a number and said there's a change, a percent change in her income. But what should the court have looked to in 2018, a year into this three-year kind of anticipated flux?
Your Honor, the court should look at the finding of fact from the judgment and decree, stating that her income was, at the time of the divorce, when the divorce decree was entered, was $167,476. Right.
But there are also findings that show that the court expected it to go down. So at some point, that number isn't the relevant number for purposes of comparison to determine the difference.
The issue with that, Your Honor, is courts should not speculate in setting a maintenance award. There's numerous case law to that effect. Carrick,
then you're appealing
Shrek,
the initial
Nelson.
Decree, really.
Well, we're not appealing the decree.
Right, but you should have. If it's speculation, that should have been the moment. So I'm looking at the modification stage. Does the district court apply the presumptions?
It should have. That's,
right.
That's an issue, Your Honor.
And did it?
It did not, no.
Okay, so did the district court do that comparison of income for not for a respondent, because his income's a little easier since the findings weren't expecting a change, right? But there was an anticipated change to her income. So the question I have is, what should the court have used, in your view, to determine whether or not that statutory presumption applies?
The court should have used the finding of appellant's income at the time the decree was entered, which again is finding of fact 35, which is $167,476. Other case law, Stitch, Rosenberg, Bredesen, Rose, specifically provide that the court has to make a finding regarding each party's income, and the analysis of your court, it's very difficult to do if there's not a finding regarding both parties' income. And the real crux of looking at a motion to modify is what the percent change in income is during that time period.
And
there's no findings regarding that. I'm sorry.
Right. I want to clarify. Sorry to interrupt you there, counsel. But you said that the district court must look at the party's income. And so are you saying that the district court is required to look at one party's income or both parties' income?
Either. Under the statute, either party, under 518.839, it could be an increase in income of one party or a decrease in another.
Because it's
here
in
we
the
have
disjunctive.
Both. It's a huge swing.
Right.
Appellant's income has gone down 46.5%. Respondent's income has gone up 40%.
Right, because the statute is written in the disjunctive. It could be either one.
Correct.
But in terms of the presumption, so I just want to make sure I understand your argument. So are you saying that the district court has to look at the income levels of the parties at the time of the decree, 167 and 342 for appellant and respondent respectively, and then look at the income
at the time of motion
to modify?
Correct.
Okay. And your argument is that the district court did not look at the income at the time of the motion for modification?
Well, the court never really made a finding regarding the income at the modification hearing.
Okay.
The court never analyzed whether there was an actual change. In addition to that, other case law provides that just finding the income isn't enough. The court needs to look at the income and look to see if appellant has the ability to pay her reasonable monthly expenses at that time. And again, there's lots of case law. There's a recent decision from the Court of Appeals after Chief Brief was filed providing for as much. at the same time, we talked about statutory presumptions. Under statute, there's two presumptions, 518A.39 subdivision 2B1, and another presumption, 518A.39 subdivision 2B5, which there's just no analysis, there's no discussion whatsoever regarding these presumptions. Additionally, we believe the circumstances are so compelling in this case that the court should modify the support awards as a matter of law.
And there's a case, so you're asking this court?
We're asking this court to do that. And there's a case, Scott, that we cite in our brief, which describes an obligor's 76% increase in income and an obligee's 47% increase in income. So that net difference is about 27%. Here, appellant's income has decreased 46.5%. The respondent's income has increased 40%, so that's an 86.5% difference. And again, that alone, as a matter of law, the court has the authority and the court should modify the spousal maintenance award consistent with these compelling circumstances.
So are you asking us to reverse and remand for the district court to make those modifications, or are you asking
us? We're asking this court to reverse, okay, and in the alternative to reverse and the remand to have the district court make that determination.
Because we're just an error-correcting court. We're not a fact-finding court.
I understand that, Your Honor, but again, there is a complete record here. The district court district court has numerous findings stating that there's only one exhibit, one self-prepared exhibit afforded by my client as a part of this proceeding. And the record reflects there's at least 23 different exhibits.
When were those filed?
They were filed at different points. There was 18 submissions made on June 12th. There were other submissions made. Appellant did file a motion to strike. I'm sorry, respondent.
Was that
did.
Motion to strike? I'll let you finish. I'm sorry. I kind of thought you were answering my previous question. Go ahead.
And that motion to strike was denied in the court's March 12, 2019 order. So all exhibits, all affidavits, all supplemental affidavits are a part of the court's record.
So the motion was to strike affidavits filed in July of 2018, shortly before the hearing, and you're saying that that motion to strike was denied?
As a part of the court's March 12, 2019 order.
And what consideration did the court give the affidavits that were filed in July, the attachments?
Again, Your Honor, the court has several findings stating there's only one exhibit that appellant had provided the court, one self-prepared exhibit, which is completely erroneous. Again, on June 12, 2018, she filed 18 different exhibits. As far as the exhibits, she provided her 1099s, her gross commissions by month, itemized list of her assets under management, her tax returns, both federal and state. So there's a lot of information that she provided regarding her income. And again, just the court's finding stating that there's only one exhibit, that's just clearly erroneous and should be remanded on that fact alone.
What about the district court's comment that the respondent appellant here failed to produce her 2017 tax returns? And maybe you addressed that and I missed it.
I'm happy to. We actually have a footnote regarding that issue.
Okay.
The parties appeared for trial in February of 2017. They're divorced in July of 2017. She did, in fact, provide her 2016 tax return in the order, and the 2016 tax return was filed jointly by the parties because they were married at that time. The 2017 return, if that's what the district court was referring to.
So I guess I understood.
Did in fact produce that.
I understood the district court's comment on the 2017 return to be one of the reasons for denial of modification as opposed to the original. Just let me finish. I'm just trying to keep clear what my question is, which probably just didn't come out very well. Sure. So, but that's the reference I see is in the motion to deny modification. So was the 2017 tax return submitted to the court as of the motion to modify?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Okay.
5 days before the hearing. Along with that, the court did award attorney's fees to respondent. And the basis for that was seemingly that appellant had filed repetitious motions. She's only filed one motion to modify spousal maintenance and child support. And this is...
But I think the point made by the district court is she's raising this very same issue over and over. Look at the difference in our income. Like, that was the point that the district court was trying to make.
And again, parties have a due process issue to be heard on these issues. In Sackowich, which we cited, and I think there's some very important language from that case because it describes the duty that the court has to review party circumstances as they change. And the court has a duty to look at it. Again, these are very compelling circumstances in my mind, especially with the huge fluctuations in both parties' respective incomes. And because of that, there's just no basis for the attorney fee award. And the attorney fee award, again, is based upon appellant producing one single self-prepared exhibit, which just simply is not true. It does not reflect the record.
Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Feel free to wrap up.
If you had a concluding statement, feel free to wrap up.
I'll talk about it on the rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ann Hansa. I represent the respondent in this matter, John Jack Warrington. The primary issues before the court raised by the appellant are that appellant's belief was that the district court erred in denying the appellant's motion to modify child support and spousal maintenance, the appellant's belief that the district court erred in failing to make detailed findings regarding the appellant's motion to extend the duration of the spousal maintenance, and the appellant's belief that the district court erred in awarding respondent conduct-based attorney's fees. The procedural history of this case is fairly important. I would like to just correct a factual inaccuracy. Following the trial, but before the entry of the judgment and decree, the respondent in this matter took on an additional position known as a check airman. It wasn't a promotion. It was simply a teaching position. He was flying his regular routes, and as a result of that, he was going to be teaching co-pilots to fly the airplanes. That information was provided to the judge, the district court, and on the motion to reopen was denied. It was not a raise in income. And I also wanted to clarify for the record.
Did it result in more income?
A minimal amount of income, it did.
A minimal. Define a minimal. Because you argued nominal at the district court level. What's nominal or minimal?
At that point, when we were made our submissions, the respondent had not yet started the position. So I can't quantify that for you.
What about when the motion for I'm blanking on the name. The motion that had been made by appellant.
The motion for amended findings?
No.
Modification.
Motion for modification. The court did make extensive findings of fact in the trial court or the court order regarding the overtime income. The court noted and the respondent provided the court with all of his overtime income, and that's in finding of fact number 11 and 13, citing what his overtime income was in 2017 as well as the overtime income in 2018.
And how much was that income?
The overtime income in 2017 was $32,054. That's finding of fact number 13. And in number 2018, he made $72,870 in overtime income.
So how is that not looking at that roughly, that is about a 10% increase in income for 2017 and roughly a 20% increase in income for 2018?
I agree.
So how is that nominal?
Back in 2017, following the trial, the additional income that came as a result of the check airman position was different and distinct from the overtime income. Those are two different.
Is that more income then?
It's inclusive in the total. But as it turned out, the check airman position, he didn't end up starting it right away, which is why he took on the overtime income.
Okay, so I guess my question is, at the time of the decree in 2017, and at the time that the motion for modification was made, was there a change in his income, husband's income?
There wasn't a change in the way he was paid, no, other than the additional overtime income.
Was there a change in the amount of income that he received?
Only to the extent that he received the overtime income.
So I take it that's a yes?
Yes, that's a yes.
Okay, so he did receive about approximately 20% increase in income in 2018 over what he had, what the district court found in 2017.
That you are correct.
Okay.
But I wanted just the court to understand the distinction between the additional income that he would have received as a result of his duties as an instructor versus the overtime income that he received by picking up extra trips.
And we certainly appreciate that clarification as to where the income is coming from, but the bottom line is there was an increase in income. Where does the district court discuss that increase in income?
In the district court's findings, number 13, it explains that petitioner now has increased income with his new position at FedEx. Part of the income comes from the hours he worked, which is considered full-time, so I can read it, but finding fact 13 outlines that.
Okay, so where does the district court discuss whether or not that invokes the rebuttable presumption under 518.39?
There's two components to a motion to modify. Has the recipient of spousal maintenance shown that there is some additional need versus the ability to pay?
I understand that. I'm familiar with the statute. I'm just asking about this first part to whether or not there had been a change in circumstances based on an increase in income from either the husband or a decrease from wife. So there are several moving parts here, but I don't see anywhere in the record where the district court discusses whether or not the rebuttable assumptions even kick in.
I don't know that they use those exact words, but there are findings clearly in finding 11 and number 12 where the court made a finding that respondent, in this case the appellant, that her reasonable monthly expenses have not significantly increased. The court also made a finding that there is no evidence that petitioner, respondent in this matter, his monthly expenses have not significantly decreased.
What about let's separate maintenance from child support? So in terms of child support modification, you would still look at even respondents' increase in income alone, regardless of expenses, regardless of appellant's change in income. Even a respondent's change in income could trigger ongoing child support modification.
That is correct.
So does the district court, for purposes of addressing the child support modification motion, ever discuss the potentially applicable statutory presumption?
I think the difficulty that the court had, and they made specific findings on that, was that based on the lack of information, the omitted information, that the court didn't know exactly, and the findings specifically said that the court talks about the lack of information, and this omission is consistent, and in sum, the court can only speculate.
So you're referring to it sounds like the district court looked at what appellant had submitted and decided that because there was no guidelines worksheet, they couldn't address child support?
That is my opinion, yes. So the appellant failed to produce a specific number. Now, counsel stated 89,000 and some change was the number that her position was on her income. For purposes of the spousal maintenance, the court raised concerns about the fact that there was no evidence as to whether she was actively seeking new employment, because this is exactly what.
But again, on the child support side, are you saying that, are you conceding there was error for not applying the rebuttable presumption for purposes
Absolutely
of the child
not.
Support motion? Okay, so where did the district court apply the presumption?
The district court couldn't apply the presumption because the district court didn't have sufficient information to make a determination as to what was appellant's income.
But again, for purposes of child support, they can look solely at respondent's income. And you just pointed out finding of fact 13, which would address that. So it seems like they would have sufficient information to address the change in respondent's income.
They could have, but I mean, the court made a determination that he didn't have income information as it related to the petitioner. So again,
that's a separate issue. The district court can make that analysis based on husband's income alone.
They could have, yes.
Okay, but so where's the analysis of that?
There isn't analysis in the order on that.
Is or is not?
There is not.
Okay, so isn't that error from the district court right there?
No, I don't believe it is.
Why not?
Because the court, from a person requesting a modification, needs to provide the court with information on both present, current income in order for the court to make a determination
that
there's been...
You're talking about her income, though. I'm just talking about husband's income.
Correct.
And the district court had that information.
They did, but they need both parties' income, both parties' current income information to make that decision, in my opinion.
Okay, fair enough. But even in your brief, you acknowledge the 1099 forms and tax information that wife provided. The district court makes no mention of that whatsoever, the additional information provided. Just says wife only provided one document, and that's it. And that's not reflected by the record, where you've got a number of exhibits that were submitted, including ones that to which you refer to in your brief.
I would make note for the record that nowhere in the district court's order does it say that appellant only provided one document. I've heard that representation. Counsel refers to finding of fact number 9. Number 9 does not say that appellant only produced a single one-page document.
It doesn't refer to a single one-page document, but let me rephrase it this way. Is there any reference to any of the other exhibits, including the 1099 forms, including the tax return forms that appellant had filed by the district court?
Yes, there is. There's references throughout the document regarding the exhibits that were produced. The court raised concern about the fact that they were self-produced exhibits.
But that goes to the cover document that she produced. That doesn't go, the 1099 or the tax return forms, that's not referring to that. It's referring to that overall document, that chart or spreadsheet that she put together.
Correct.
That's different than a 1099 or a tax return document.
That is correct, Your Honor, but the court also raised concerns about the appellant's failure to produce documents to support the business expenses that were on the tax return. That was an issue that was raised at the trial court level, and the trial court cautioned the appellant about making the supporting documents available, and the court in its findings raised concerns that income that's reported on a tax return for a self-employed person isn't necessarily reflective of what the actual income is that the self-employed person is receiving.
Right, but she produced those documents as well in terms of what exact expenses she was writing off for business expenses, and even, if I recall correctly, even arguing the alternative, even if the district court doesn't accept these, my income still has gone down substantially from where it was at the time of the judgment and dissolution decree.
As it relates to the spousal maintenance, I think the arguments are different as it relates to spousal maintenance and to the child support. From the child support perspective, the court didn't have, at least as I read the order, sufficient information to develop and determine exactly what the current income is, to do the math calculation to determine whether or not there had been a change in circumstances. In my opinion, that was appellant's obligation to produce the math calculation to the court to suggest that there had been a change, that it had met the statutory change of 20% and 75%. And in fact, if you do the math, because the overnights, the child support laws change. If you actually do the math calculation, even though the appellant or the respondent's income had increased, the way the child support laws change, counting overnights, I would suggest to the court that the statutory presumption would not have been met.
How do we know that, though? Because there's no analysis of that by the district court.
There isn't. I would agree with you, but
and that's my main concern is there's no analysis of that issue by the district court. At least with respect to the child support issue. And don't we need that in order to determine whether or not the district court erred or not?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Again, my review of the court's order is that the person seeking the modification has the burden to provide the court with accurate and current information. And the court couldn't necessarily do the calculation on the child support because the person, the appellant in this case, seeking the modification, failed to provide the court with current. She provided the court with 2017 information, but we're in court in July of 2018, The court had zero information on what her 2018 income information is to be able to conduct the calculation, would be my answer.
So what information did the appellant provide with regard to deducting business expenses?
Nothing. Okay. There was no documentation to support any of the business expenses that she claimed.
What about a trial?
Nothing.
But the court still made findings at trial.
The court made some findings on what were the, but the court also cautioned her and made her aware of the fact that it is appropriate to produce the records to support the, business expenses.
The lack of evidence to support the business expenses at trial didn't preclude the court from determining what her income was.
That's true. That is correct.
So why couldn't the district court do the same thing on the motion or modification?
Because the district court didn't have in 2018, didn't have any information on appellant's 2018 income. That, I think, was the site in finding of fact number 9, that the court was concerned that the appellant failed to provide any information and basically said
but,
the court
But she provided information on 2017. You're not going to get the 2018 full information until after the year is completed, though.
That's true, but you would, in July of 2018, we would have a good 6 months' worth of data that the court could have used for purposes of...
Why wasn't the 2017 information enough to say, okay, yeah, there has been a change now?
Because 6 months had passed in 2018, and her income information could have changed dramatically because her position at trial was that my income was going to go down and then start to go up again, and I think... I'm speculating, but that there's a possibility that the income could have started to increase again following the, the first 6 months of 2018. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
With regard to, respondent keeps claiming he was receiving overtime income. Again, we talked about the FAA regulations, and in addition, this additional income, overtime income, you either get time and a half or two times what you work. He never received anything like that, and none of that is reflected on his pay stubs. With regard to the income that Ms. Warrington had at the time of the modification hearing, she had just been disassociated with McVain, where she had been there for almost 30 years. She literally had zero earned income at that point. As a matter just to be reasonable and just to try to say, well, impute some income to me, she came up with $89,000, which is reflected in her reply brief. And that just reflects the amount of income she earned during that previous year.
And when did disassociation take effect again?
It took effect in, I believe, July or late June, and the hearing was held in July.
Of 2018?
Of 2018. And she had filed a supplemental brief identifying she was no longer associated with McVain, and she didn't have any earned income at that point. So for that reason, I mean, there's a lot of documentation in the record showing that she's not even working earning anything at that point.
So the district court found in the modification, in its modification decision, that the wife had testified that, and this was at the time of the dissolution hearing, I believe, that if she lost her income from McVain, she believed she could generate $75,000 a year as a Schedule C employee. And that, of course, as everyone has acknowledged, that she was no longer at McVain as of the time of the modification. So then the district court goes on to say that she claims her income decreased drastically but has not provided the court with persuasive evidence to support this assertion other than a summary exhibit or shown how there is additional analysis of how she would supplement. Because she testified regarding what she would do when she lost her connection with McVain. Does the record support those findings by the district court?
And, Your Honor, the issue with this is there's a lot of speculation. You know, what's my income going to be in the future? And there's numerous cases that caution courts and basically find it's erroneous, it's an error of law for courts to speculate in that regard. And for a lot of folks, and I've cited numerous cases in our brief, but for a lot of courts, you got to wait until an unexpected change in circumstances happens.
Well, district courts are given broad discretion in that. I mean, I'm well aware of the cases that you cite, but there's also cases that say caution on Carrick and its progeny and say, well, you can. A lot of this is going to be speculative. The district court can take several approaches. It can say, okay, this is what we're going to do going forward. This is what we expect is going to happen. District court can leave the record open for the parties to come back, review hearing, 6 months, 12 months. If there, nobody really knows what is going to happen, there, change, motion for modification. So lots of different avenues the district court can take. So I'm not so sure if it's pure error by the district court to take this approach.
In the court's most recent order, there's no finding saying that she should be earning that amount or anything to that effect.
And no, in but fact, the district court indicates that it's your client failed her burden of proof and that she didn't present evidence showing, as she had testified at the decree, that she would take steps to deal with the loss of the McVeigh work. And that, and for instance, finding of fact four is that the wife did not provide the court with any evidence that she's actively seeking to acquire new clients or new work.
And again, Your Honor, this happened so quick. She was at McVeigh for about 30 years. Along with that.
But you filed the motion to modify. I mean, you controlled that timing.
Well, we filed it in June, and shortly after it was filed, she became disassociated with her job where she's been for 30 years. Which is why, again, she filed a supplemental affidavit identifying as much. She never anticipated that Charlie McVeigh would retire on the namesake of the firm. She never anticipated that there'd be heavy fines levied by the SEC against her trading firm. There's just a lot of turmoil. And along with that, we did file a motion for need-based attorney's fees. And along with that, appellant earns approximately $60,000 a year. While Mr. Warrington responded.
Does the disparity matter in terms of need-based fees?
It does, Your Honor.
What authority says the disparity matters?
Under 518.14, these are need-based fees that we're looking at, and it looks at the ability to pay. A respondent clearly has that ability. Appellant, she cannot maintain legal counsel if need-based attorney's fees are not awarded, and she's presenting her argument in good faith and for a proper purpose. I have no more, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. It was very well argued and very well briefed as well. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the statutory time frame.